From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, whose values are family values? We'll talk to Robert Knight of the Family Research Council, a Washington-based lobbying group. He says that the two-parent heterosexual family is the foundation of civilization, and anything else is dysfunctional. Then we'll go to Oregon, where Initiative Number 9 is on the ballot. If passed, it would amend the Oregon Constitution to classify homosexuality as wrong, unnatural, and perverse, and would allow discrimination against homosexuals. We'll talk to activists working for and against the initiative. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Bush is placing an air cap over Shiite villages in southern Iraq. But even before the president's announcement today, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein moved his airplanes out of the zone and halted ground attacks on the Shiites. Barry Schwide reports.
It looks like a confrontation that may not be a confrontation. If Saddam Hussein is looking for a fight with the U.S. and its allies, he's not likely to risk it in the skies over Shiite villages. And even on the ground, there is no sign anymore of Iraqi attacks on the Shiites. The American, British, and French reconnaissance planes will be looking for a resumption of those attacks. And if Saddam Hussein turns on the heat again, there could be a clash. Last year, declining to impose a cap, U.S. officials said Iraq could be a quagmire for American forces. The question now is whether they have changed that assessment and are willing to get into a ground fight to protect Saddam's domestic foes. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Hurricane Andrew blasted Louisiana before being downgraded to a tropical storm this afternoon. At least one person died in Louisiana, bringing the U.S. death toll to 16. Three other people died in the Bahamas before Andrew moved on to the United States. Already labeled the most expensive natural disaster in U.S. history, Andrew added to the $15 billion Florida bill when it struck the southern Gulf Coast today. A tornado spun off from Andrew and ripped through the town of LaPlace, a suburb of New Orleans. President Bush declared parts of Louisiana a disaster area. He's en route to the state to inspect the damage for himself. The most ambitious conference yet on the Bosnian conflict got underway today in London, but as NPR's Michael Sullivan reports, the conference got off to a shaky start.
The leader of the Bosnian Serbs, Radovan Karadzic, walked out of the talks only hours after they had begun. He complained that his delegation did not enjoy the same status as that of the mainly Muslim Bosnian government. He said it was impossible to talk peace if there was nowhere for him to sit. It's unclear what effect Karadzic's walkout will have, since the conference is expected to focus on the conflict in Bosnia. Earlier, he said he was willing to exchange some of the territory captured by his forces in exchange for peace. Bosnia's Serbs now control nearly 70% of the republic. Conference organizers hope to get the warring parties to agree to a ban on the use of force, an end to so-called ethnic cleansing, the closure of detention camps, and respect for international frontiers. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
A federal judge declared a mistrial today in the Iran-Contra cover-up case of former CIA official Claire George. The jurors said they were hopelessly deadlocked. A new trial date is tentatively set for October 19th, but it's not clear if prosecutors intend to retry the case. George was accused of lying to Congress about a cover-up in the Arms for Hostages deal. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 14.5 points at 3246. This is NPR. According to a new legal opinion being weighed by the Bush administration, President Bush could order on his own authority the indexation for inflation of capital gains. Steve Beckner of Market News Service reports.
For years, the federal government has taxed gains from the sale of all kinds of assets on the basis of their original cost, regardless of how much of the gain is real and how much is due to inflation. Thus, a taxpayer who bought a home for $100,000 in 1982 and sold it for $200,000 in 92 would be taxed on a gain of $100,000, even though in those 10 years inflation has driven up prices so much that that $200,000 he received has the same purchasing power $100,000 had in 82. Even though the house has merely kept pace with inflation, the homeowner is taxed on the whole nominal gain and ends up with a real loss on the sale of his home. There's bipartisan support for adjusting the cost of homes and other capital assets for inflation, but Congress has failed to do so. Now a legal brief prepared on behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and National Taxpayers Union contends President Bush can order the IRS to index capital gains without an act of Congress. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
A Brazilian congressional committee approved a report today by a large margin saying President Fernando Collor profited from corruption. The vote opens the way to impeachment hearings and a possible criminal trial. Under Brazilian law, the report now goes to the Attorney General for possible criminal proceedings. The Brazilian Congress does not need to vote on the document. Pakistan says about 40,000 Afghan refugees from Kabul are now in Pakistan. They are fleeing the war between Afghan government troops and forces loyal to dissident leader Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees confirmed the figure and said between 100 and 150 families arrive in Pakistan every day. There's a report that Kabul is asking the UN and Pakistan to open a refugee shelter in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, rather than permit the refugees to cross into Pakistan. I'm Corva Coleman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The emphasis on family values in this year's presidential campaign is good news for my guest, Bob Knight. He works with the Family Research Council, a lobbying group in Washington, D.C. He directs the Council's Cultural Studies Project, examining issues related to gender and sexual orientation and federal funding of the arts. He previously was a senior fellow at the conservative think tank the Heritage Foundation. Today brought some potentially bad news for Knight. A New York Times-CBS News poll indicates that the public is far more interested in hearing the presidential candidates address the economy and health care than family values and homosexuality. I asked Knight for his reaction to the poll.
Well, I think it's all tied together. Economics cannot be divorced from family values. They're very much a part of family values. If families can't afford to protect their children in the way they hope to do so because of economic considerations, that becomes a family issue. And families today are so overtaxed that they're being forced to make decisions that they'd rather not. They're being forced to make choices that they'd rather not be forced into, such as putting children in daycare. This is not to say some children will not be placed in daycare, but what has been missed in the debate is the argument that we need a level playing field that would allow parents who favor parental care just the same sort of tax advantages that you can now get by placing your child in daycare.
In the first part of your statement, I thought you were paraphrasing Bill Clinton. Isn't that his platform, that the greatest threat to families now is a failing economy, and that's why we should be focusing on the economy instead of family values?
Yeah, he talks a good game, but from what I've seen of his program, he would exacerbate the problem by raising taxes on all families. It looks like a gimmick to me, this idea of taxing the rich to relieve the middle class. It never works out that way. The middle class is always the prime target because the middle class has the money. If you taxed everything from the top 5% of all Americans, I think it would only run government for a few days. It's nonsense to use this Robin Hood rhetoric to try to get middle-class votes. It might work if he fools enough people.
You're emphasizing that it's taxes that are destroying the family, but if there's an economic problem, isn't the greater problem unemployment and low wages?
I think the main problem is a crisis of values. And
wait, you just said that the real problem was the economy.
Well, I think the problem is the economy is shackled by a huge government that is trying to take the part of the family. Government, as it grows, takes on family functions, child care, moral instruction. Just about every function that used to be performed by the family has been taken on by government, done badly. It has exacerbated social problems, and now we're being asked to support even more social programs to make up for the damage that the government has already done. I think if families are encouraged to stay together and are left alone, that, more than anything else, would solve not only our social problems, but our economic problems.
You had just said a moment ago that really what the government should do is not take on all these responsibilities, and yet family values is like a key part of the Republican platform. So what exactly do you think the government role should be in family life?
I think it ought to support the privacy and sovereignty of the two-parent traditional family as best it can, since that's the building block of civilization. It's not just another configuration, not just an accident of people happening to live together. Today, more and more policies are being framed that treat the two-parent heterosexual traditional family as just one variant. And that's got to stop, because that has hurt us more than anything.
So you want the government to encourage the primacy of the two-parent heterosexual family. What do you want the government to do to encourage the primacy of that particular type of family?
Yeah, I don't even use that rhetoric, that particular type of family. That's the family, mom, dad, and the kids. Anything else is a dysfunctional family or an arbitrary grouping. I don't think two lesbians and a poodle is a family. It's a household, perhaps, and they have rights
What about a single mother whose husband left her and the kids? Was that a family?
It's a family, but it's a dysfunctional family. It's unfortunate because the children need fathers. And this idea that a single-parent family is the equivalent of a two-parent family is a lie. Everybody knows it, most of all single mothers who have to bear those burdens.
What about in a family where the two parents aren't in love anymore and they feel that they should get a divorce, that the marriage is just not working? Should the government do anything there?
Well, the government already has encouraged them to split by making it easier and easier to do so and to pay the woman, step into daddy's role with a paycheck, and say, don't worry, if you split, we'll take care of everything. That's not a neutral role. That's an attack role. That encourages adults not to live up to their vows and to their responsibilities to their children. You know, we've got this cultural problem of individual choice, that choice is the icon. It's above all. We don't talk about obligations. We certainly don't talk about sacrifice anymore. And we confuse sacrifice, real compassion, with the idea that the government should do something about it. I'd like to see government quit interfering with families and actually supporting them. You're right, I'm not neutral about this. I would like to see the government openly support tax policies that encourage families to stay together instead of to break up. And one way to do that would be to increase the tax exemption for children. Right now, it's at, I think, $2,500. And in 1948, when families were much more supported by government, it was, I think, at $800. The equivalent today would be $8,000 to give parents the same sort of tax relief they had in 1948. And now taxes at all levels, federal, state, and local, are taking a far greater share of family income, forcing many mothers to work and many fathers to take two jobs. This is the government at war with the family. And what the government offers is, okay, we'll help you out. We've taxed you into this situation. Now we're going to offer you programs. We'll take care of your children. You need not do that anymore. We'll provide welfare. We'll step in with all these things that you could have been doing yourselves if we just left you alone.
Let me ask you if you think that your rhetoric matches your positions. In other words, you're saying that you think that the government should get out of family life.
No, it ought to encourage family life.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you told me that the government should get out of family life. On the other hand,
I'd settle for them getting out.
Right. But, so quit interfering with families was the language that you used. But
yeah.
On the other hand, you want government to make it harder for a couple to divorce. You want the government to establish what a family really is, a two-parent heterosexual family. So it seems to me, really, although your rhetoric is about the government not interfering with families, the policies that you're advocating is about the government defining families and making it more difficult for families to split up. So isn't that really advocating more government interference in family life?
No, that's nonsense. I'm talking about the government removing policies that now tend to lead people into splitting up. Divorce law is very significant. Because everywhere divorce laws have been eased, divorces have soared. It sent a societal message that you need not live up to your vows or your contract. To me, this is there's an interesting lawsuit underway, and it's a man who didn't want to be divorced from his wife, loves his children, and is suing his wife to the effect that she has broken a contract she agreed to. They took vows to love and cherish each other. I think he's got a good case that it's a breach of contract. We really worry about whether a used car we buy is up to the terms of the contract, and we'll fight tooth and nail for that. But when it comes to the vows of a marriage, marriages don't get much legal support anymore, even though they're probably the most important contract we can make.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Knight, and he's with the Family Research Council. He directs the Cultural Studies Project. And the Family Research Council is the lobbying and education division of Focus on the Family. Can you give us your report card on the Republican and Democratic parties so far in the presidential campaign? Let's start with the Republicans, since they just had their convention and we heard their platform most recently.
Yeah. Well, I like a lot of their rhetoric, but again, I'm more interested in policies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a conservative, and I would like to see government taken down a peg. I'd like to see less government and therefore less taxation. I think I trust the people more than a lot of policymakers do to lead their own lives. I think government does have a role, though, in fostering things that are proven to be beneficial. And I think the Republicans, if they follow through on the policies they say they're interested in, would be on the right track. I think Bill, now onto the Democrats.
Yeah.
I think the Bill Clinton has is smart enough to have picked up on the family values rhetoric. He knows it resonates in every American household, and he's a smart politician, and I don't blame him for capitalizing on it. But the Democratic Party policies over the years traditionally have been to increase government at the expense of families, to offer social programs instead of policies that would encourage people to care for their own and to stay together. And I don't see any change there. I don't see any fundamental thrust. If anything, I see a loosening of standards, a loosening of sexual standards. The Democrats have embraced the gay rights agenda. And what gay rights is not about tolerance. It's not about diversity. It's about a well-financed, well-organized group of political activists who want to force their lifestyle on other people. Witness the Boy Scouts. They've been going along for 82 years with their values intact, and suddenly they're under fierce attack by homosexual groups, by atheists, by even feminist groups who want to mix girls in with them. This is not about tolerance and diversity. If we really believed in that, we'd let the Scouts be the Scouts. Homosexuals can form their own organizations. It is a free country. But when they try to impose their values on a traditional value-minded organization like the Boy Scouts, you can see they're the aggressors. They're not the victims.
If a homosexual wants to have a job, or housing, is that forcing his values on somebody else?
Well, it depends on the situation. I know cases in which landlords who have families in their houses have had a very difficult time. They've had quiet homosexuals who don't bother anyone, and I don't think anyone really objects to that. But in one instance, a guy held orgies, and guys were coming and going, and this guy was unable to evict that tenant because he fell back on gay rights, saying, oh, you're just after me because I'm a homosexual.
Well, I think
whereas
it's fair to say,
if he was heterosexual, mm-hmm. and he had women at all hours, mm-hmm. and they felt it was impacting on families badly, you'd think the landlord would have a right to protect the other families in the building. But they always use gay rights. It's kind of a trump card. I can do anything I want, and now I can use this card of bigotry to play against you. You go along with my game, or you're a bigot. I'm going to smear you.
Well, let me say, if we follow your logic, then if we can find a case in which an African-American has used discrimination as a way to get the upper hand in a situation in which they were actually in the wrong, if they exploited equal rights in that situation, then maybe we should consider not giving African-American civil rights because a couple of people have exploited it.
How about giving everyone the same civil rights?
Well, that's, I think, what the question is.
No, it isn't. It's about special privileges where you have a particular legal standing based on, in this case, a sexual orientation. And you can't compare the homosexual struggle with that of the black civil rights movement. For starters, it's a behavior. It's not an immutable characteristic like race in which you can't really hide it. You look in an auditorium, you can't tell who's gay and who isn't. You can only tell when someone's gay is when if they make a point of it. But the only civil rights protections we have now that are special, that single people out, are because of ethnic origin, race, handicap, sex, and religious preferences. And that's based in the Constitution. There's nothing that has ever been drawn from the Constitution that indicates we should now grant special privileges based on behaviors. If you start doing that, the sky is wide open to give special privileges based on any kind of behavior, whether it's nail biting or alcoholism. I think that Americans with Disabilities Act has opened the door wide to that kind of distinction.
You've said that homosexuality only becomes an issue when homosexuals make it one. That is when they force their choice of behavior or approval of their choice of behavior on others.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is it's okay to be homosexual as long as you keep it a secret and never do anything in public that would all reveal your orientation. Is that not like saying, in a way, it's okay to practice Judaism as long as you don't practice it in public because, by the way, we're closing down all the synagogues?
See, again, you're making the false comparison between religion and a behavior.
No, I'm just saying about whether something's, you know, you can practice something as long as it's not in public. That's what I'm trying to make the analogy.
Yeah, well, some things shouldn't be practiced in public. That's why we have public laws to that effect. That's why we have laws against public nudity, because that would create such a sexual tension.
But for you, practicing in public is just saying that's what you are, not having sex in public.
Or why would you define yourself by your sexuality anyway?
Well, I'm sure you'd let us know you're heterosexual, and you'd have no problem with that.
I mean,
you want the family to be defined by its heterosexuality.
That's because the family is defined by its heterosexuality, and that's universal. That's not something we cooked up in late 20th century America. I mean, that's just men and women. That's how nature works, and any variant from that is indeed a variant and should not be equated with what has been the natural relations between men and women for centuries, for thousands of years.
Can I be honest with you? I'm always really surprised when people like yourself are very, very comfortable speaking so negatively about a whole group of people.
No, not the people, the practice. I have friends who are homosexuals.
That was going to be my next
question.
And
I worry about them. No, they're very good friends. In fact, I've got a couple who are like brothers to me. And I worry about them. I worry about what they do because I know the statistics. It's a very unhealthy lifestyle generally. I hope they remain monogamous. I don't know if they have. But just as I would have a friend who's an alcoholic, I could still love that person and not approve of his abuse of alcohol. I have homosexual friends, and I can disapprove of homosexual behavior and still love them. It's the old Christian concept of you condemn the sin but not the sinner, because we're all sinners. We all fall short. And homosexuals are no different from anybody else in that regard.
But let me ask you, do you have long debates with your homosexual friends about homosexuality? Or is it something you really talk about a lot with them?
No, because it isn't an issue.
Uh-huh.
I just see them as people. And we talk about anything, sports, movies, whatever.
Uh-huh.
They haven't made it an issue. Now, if they came to me and said, look, we want to present a positive portrayal of this to your children. We want to impose on them the idea that this is just as good an arrangement as what you and your wife have, that's where I'd part company with them. I'd say, well, I'm sorry, I'm uncomfortable with that. But so far they have not done that because these are decent guys who know what they're doing is variant, it's abnormal, and would not push it on other people. They respect families.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Bob Knight. He directs the Family Research Council's Cultural Studies Project. And this is the Lobbying and Education Division of Focus on the Family. We'll take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Bob Knight is my guest of the Family Research Council, formerly a researcher with the Heritage Foundation. During the Reagan years, many of the pro-family groups were headed by televangelists. And
a couple of them were. Jerry Falwell, Moral Majority.
Right.
I don't know. What other one are you talking about? Pat Robertson, maybe?
Yeah. Also, I guess what I'm thinking here is that I think the pro-family... Pro-family values were often espoused the most by televangelists and preached the most by televangelists. But in the intervening years, many of those televangelists have been discredited. And I wonder what effect you think that's had on the pro-family movement.
Well, I eye a lot of the televangelists with a lot of criticism. Some of them are okay. I have no problem with them. Others, I think, are opportunists. And I don't think they really reflect the great mandate they feel they've been given. It just so happens the main proponents of family values, the Jerry Falwells, the Pat Robertsons, have never been discredited. They're honorable men who are going about their business. Some of the other evangelists, Jim Baker, has been discredited. I never saw him as a major spokesman for family values in the first place. I always did view him with a critical eye. So, but I think it's hurt. I think the idea is the media in particular has painted with a very broad brush, trying to say two things. One, because a few televangelists are scoundrels, then all of them are. And two, this must mean all Christians are scoundrels. I see it as a major attack on just the idea of Christianity itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the gay rights agenda as the first step in the criminalization of Christianity in this country, because it's an effort to say you cannot hold those beliefs and we're going to go after you with everything we've got, with any all the government power we can muster. We're going to say that you cannot believe what you believe.
Obviously, you think that homosexuality is doing everything close to bringing the apocalypse. I mean,
No. I just see them as the organized homosexuals, not the many homosexuals who are minding their own business, living their lives. I'm talking about the militants who have organized. I see them as the vanguard in the cultural war, yes. They're on the cutting edge in the arts debate, in the debate over sex education, what should be included, what should be left out, what's proper content for public broadcasting. You can find them at the cutting edge, and I think they have cut that role out for them.
In talking about family values, this is a question that often comes to mind. Now President Reagan was one of the big political supporters of a pro-family platform, family values platform. In President Reagan's own life, we saw that he had been divorced, and in coming to know more about the family over the years, we found out that Patty Davis, his daughter, lived out of wedlock with a lover. She took drugs. She says in her memoirs that her mother, Nancy Reagan, treated her abusively. I'm not trying to pass judgment on the family, but I'm wondering what you make of that, that somebody who was leading the pro-family value platform really had troubles in his own family. And what does that say?
Well,
I'll leave that for you to interpret.
Well, I think it's ironic and unhappy that all these things occurred. I don't think that discredits President Reagan's embrace of the pro-family agenda. He knew what was right and true and worth protecting, even if his own family didn't live up to that ideal. But I think that may be part of the problem of why the Reagan agenda wasn't fully completed. It kind of fell apart in that second term. The commitment seemed to disappear. And I thought some of what happened was regrettable. And I'd like to see more commitment to the pro-family agenda. But as far as the Reagans, I mean, there is no perfect family in the United States. That doesn't mean we should stop making distinctions between what is good and right and true and noble and just and what is the best environment for raising children. In no way does it discredit the president's advocacy of traditional families. As I say, it's a very unhappy thing, but there's unhappiness in a lot of families. Does not discredit the idea of family.
Okay. Well, Bob Knight, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for talking with me, Terry.
Bob Knight directs the Cultural Studies Project of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Homosexuality has become a campaign issue this year, both in the presidential race and locally in Oregon, where Initiative 9 is on the ballot. If passed, open discrimination against gay people would become legal. The state government would be required to actively discourage homosexuality. Coming up, we'll talk with activists on both sides of the anti-gay initiative. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Tons of food and supplies are pouring into Florida to help assist the 50,000 people left homeless by Hurricane Andrew. The Metro Dade County Office of Emergency Management said workers are setting up staging points to get food and water out into stricken communities. The Federal Office of Emergency Management is unloading military rations in Florida and is beginning its assistance efforts on the Gulf Coast as well, according to Associate Director Grant Peterson.
We have 100,000 meals ready to eat that are on standby right now with 1,000 rolls of heavy-duty plastic for roof covering. The DMAT teams, the Disaster Military Assistance teams, are staged and ready to go. Two are out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. One is out of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Peterson says the administration and Congress may have to come up with hundreds of millions of dollars to help pay for the destruction caused by Hurricane Andrew. Insurance companies are being overwhelmed with claims as the damage toll rises in Florida and Louisiana. Official estimates on the number of claims aren't expected until next week. But some industry officials say Andrew could match or exceed Hurricane Hugo's $4.2 billion in claims. Hugo was the insurance industry's costliest hurricane so far. Total claims ended up costing about half the entire damage estimate of $8 billion. President Bush announced the Allies will impose a ban on Iraqi military flights over southern Iraq. The restriction will go into effect tomorrow at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. The effort is intended to protect Shiite Muslims who are rebelling against Baghdad. Mr. Bush says he's informed Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton of his action. Clinton released a statement today voicing his support for the move. Voting assistance in languages other than English will be available in many communities this November under the terms of a bill President Bush signed into law today. NPR's Paz Cohen has more.
Bilingual ballots and other language assistance have been part of the Voting Rights Act since 1975, but the bilingual provisions expired earlier this month. The bill signed today renews and expands the old provisions. It also keeps them in force until the entire Voting Rights Act, which is meant to empower minorities, comes up for renewal in the year 2007. Under the new law, language assistance for registration and voting will be available in jurisdictions where either 5% of voting-age citizens or 10,000 adult citizens have limited English skills. The numerical threshold is new and means Los Angeles County, San Francisco, Chicago, and Philadelphia, among other places, will be covered by the bilingual provisions for the first time starting this year. At the Capitol, I'm Paz Cohen.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained about 14.5 points to end the day at 3,246.81. Advances led declines by a margin of about 10 to 7. This is NPR. A New York Times CBS poll finds that Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton maintains a 15-point lead over President Bush in a survey of registered voters. That's just 2 points less for Clinton than he scored in a similar survey taken just before the Republican National Convention. Also, 90% of those questioned said they were more interested in hearing about the economy and health care. The government says durable goods orders to American factories dropped in July for the second time in 3 months. The Commerce Department says such orders fell 3.4%. That's the biggest plunge in 7 months. The agency chalked it up to a decline in aircraft orders. An 18-year-old armed gunman took hostages today at a hotel in Rapid City, South Dakota. Charles Michael Ray, a member station KBHE, reports.
Jeremiah Darrell Keaton, a resident of Box Elder, South Dakota, took approximately 18 hostages at the Rushmore Plaza Holiday Inn. According to Police Chief Hennies, negotiations brought about release of some hostages. One of the hostages, Tom King from Washington, D.C., tells about talking with Keaton while he was captive.
I early on offered that if you'll put your weapons down, I'll walk outside with you and we'll talk it over. But he didn't say no. He just said no. He just kind of politely declined. And he said, tell them that I'm not as crazy as they say I am.
Keaton's motive was unclear throughout the ordeal, and 5.5 hours later, the situation ended abruptly when Keaton shot himself in the stomach. He then called for help and was taken to Rapid City Regional Hospital, where he's being evaluated. For National Public Radio, I am Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City.
California firefighters made gains today in their fight against a 64,000-acre brush and timber blaze. The fire near Round Mountain is now thought to be arson-started. Damage estimates are at $86 million. Officials say the fire is about 75% contained. Meanwhile, in Idaho, a 257,000-acre fire caused by lightning 1 week ago is about 70% contained. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Homosexuality has become an issue in the presidential campaign. They're actually going to vote on it in Oregon. On the November ballot will be an initiative to amend Oregon's state constitution so that minority status, affirmative action, or similar concepts could not apply to homosexuality. The state and local governments would recognize homosexuality as abnormal, wrong, unnatural, and perverse. The government and the school system would be required to discourage homosexuality. Last spring, a similar initiative was passed in Springfield, Oregon. In a few minutes, we'll speak to the leader of the coalition opposing the Oregon initiative. First joining us on the telephone is Scott Lively, the communications director of the Oregon Citizens Alliance, the group that is sponsoring the initiative, Ballot Measure 9.
Measure 9 is an attempt to put a barrier between private behavior and public policy, and to say, what you do in the privacy of your own bedroom is your own business, but please don't try to get our government to sanction the homosexual lifestyle and allow it to be presented to our children in the public schools as a normal and natural alternative.
So what do you think the government should do to prevent that from happening?
Well, I think Measure 9 sufficiently addresses that by basically saying that that you cannot use tax money to promote homosexuality. You cannot teach children that homosexuality is a good and normal choice, and that you cannot extend minority benefits and affirmative action on the basis of a private sexual choice.
How has homosexuality adversely affected your life?
Well, it's rather like the issue of drug use from the 1960s. Is that when a few people were smoking pot out in a field somewhere, it really didn't hurt anybody. But when you had a widespread cultural phenomenon of drug use, it became really an epidemic and very destructive. The same sort of thing with sexual permissiveness. You know, when a couple people are out, being involved in, deviant sexual behavior, it really doesn't hurt anybody. But when it becomes a widespread social, government-sanctioned lifestyle, then we have serious problems with it. And we're saying that we've gone too far in the area of permissiveness. It's time to push back the line a little bit.
Your initiative basically equates homosexuality with pedophilia. Do you think that relations between two consenting adults of the same sex is the equivalent of pedophilia?
Well, all of us are born with the capacity to be involved in every kind of deviant sexual behavior, whether it's homosexuality or pedophilia or bestiality. It's a voluntary sexual act, and we're just saying that not necessarily that they're equal, but that they all belong on the same list of wrong sexual behavior.
Mr. Levy, do you think of yourself as a tolerant person?
I had a former homosexual man that was dying of AIDS that spent the last year of his life living with my family. And I care about these people that I feel are trapped in a dysfunctional lifestyle, and I do have tolerance and I have compassion for them, but I'm not going to condone what their behavior. I'm not going to condone a lifestyle based on sodomy.
Do you think that homosexuals should lose their jobs or their housing?
No. I think that our measure protects people's jobs, as long as they're not promoting homosexuality or the other behaviors in the workplace, and as long as they're not allowing children whom they have a regular and direct contact with to view homosexuality as a viable option for them to choose.
Your initiative would outlaw promoting, encouraging, or facilitating homosexuality. I wonder how far that goes. Say you have a public library, and in the library are novels by gay or lesbian authors, or a book that discusses homosexuality in a positive light. Would the library have to get rid of those books?
No, nothing in our measure would supersede the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And we have a document called the Statement of Legislative Intent, which and an endorsement letter from Bruce Fein, who's a major constitutional scholar, who says that nothing in the measure is going to impact the adult library materials. However, under the interest that the government enjoys in protecting children from harmful things, we might be able to challenge things like Daddy's Roommate and Heather Has Two Mommies and have them removed from the children's shelves and put in a reserved section in the adult library.
Now, what about state-funded or city-funded programs that would counsel homosexuals or would deal in any way with homosexuality without condemning homosexuality? Would they lose their funding?
No, they would be required. Basically, anybody that's using our tax money in the area of addressing homosexual behavior would be required to try to discourage the behavior. And I think that's only logical in light of the AIDS crisis and other epidemics of diseases within that are connected with the homosexual lifestyle, that when it comes to using public funds, that we should make a distinction there. And if someone wants to get pro-gay counseling, they can go to a private facility.
Scott Lively is the communications director of the Oregon Citizens Alliance, which is sponsoring ballot measure number 9 in Oregon. We'll talk with the leader of the group opposing the initiative after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Peggy Norman directs the coalition that is opposing Oregon's ballot measure 9, which would require the state government to actively discourage homosexuality. I asked Norman for her description of the initiative.
The full text of the, as they've called it, Abnormal Behaviors Initiative says three really important things. The first thing it says is that the state of Oregon and all of our subunits, so even local government, cannot use any phrase or category that refers to sexual orientation or sexual preference. And so the first thing that would do is invalidate a portion of our hate crimes law and repeal the Portland City Ordinance that refers to, along with a whole other list of protected classes in our civil rights legislation, it would repeal that as well, because it refers to sexual orientation. Second thing that the proposed law says is that state, regional, local governments, their properties and their monies can't be used, and here are the important verbs, to promote, encourage, or facilitate homosexuality, pedophilia, sadism, or masochism. So they link all those things together, and in an earlier version they even included bestiality and necrophilia, which shows you where their perspective is coming from. And that particular thing is the sort of catch-all, because whether you're promoting or encouraging or even facilitating catches a lot of people, a lot of heterosexual people, a lot of organizations that are certainly not advocates for the gay community, but also support civil rights for the gay community. So it has a real widespread effect. And the third piece, which is important, says that state, regional, local governments, and specifically our State Department of Higher Education, kindergarten through college, shall set a standard for our youth that recognizes homosexuality as abnormal, wrong, unnatural, and perverse, and to be discouraged and avoided. So it will use our state school system to teach propaganda and to promote a view of what's acceptable and tolerable and what's family that I think is really reflected in the values of only a tiny minority of Oregonians.
What do you think might come under the umbrella of promoting, encouraging, or facilitating homosexuality?
I think it's a whole raft of things. That clause means that our public libraries should not be buying books that have information that is positive about homosexuality. It means that our libraries and public television and public radio and the arts and the theater are all subject to censorship. I think it also means that if you are someone that has to be licensed by the state of Oregon, for instance, if you're a pediatrician, or you're a physician or a lawyer or an accountant, maybe you're a physical therapist, any of those people who have the requirement of getting state licensing, if you are known to be lesbian or gay, or if you serve a lesbian or gay clientele, I think that you're in jeopardy because it says that the state can't use its monies to facilitate that. It also means that if you're a group like Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, a sort of a coalition, a broad-based coalition of religious folk, but you have an HIV day center, and as part of your clientele, there are significant numbers of gay people, and you don't condemn that, you don't teach that homosexuality is perverse and to be avoided, then you probably cannot receive any county money or any state money to do your work that provides direct services to the lesbian and gay community.
What are your fears of the impact this bill will have on gay and lesbian individuals if it's passed? I mean, this initiative.
The first thing that's going to happen, and the proponents of the initiative have admitted this, is that some people are going to lose their jobs. The legislative intent written with this measure says very specifically that if you're in a job that has any contact with children, that if there is any indication that you are lesbian or gay or supportive of that community, then you have to be investigated. And if it is found that you are lesbian or gay, then you must be replaced in that job. So school teachers are going to lose their jobs. Pediatricians are going to lose their jobs. Children's librarians are going to lose their jobs. Coaches are going to lose their jobs. And the list goes on.
Could you tell us a little bit about what the experience has been like for you to go head-to-head with people who think of you as perverse and as undeserving of civil liberties?
I grew up in Oregon. I was born here. And I've seen something change as a result, direct result of this campaign. It's a state that has a reputation around the country as being pretty liberal, and at the very least that there is a lot of tolerance and acceptance of different lifestyles. What has been unleashed by this ballot measure is not only a lot of hatred and a lot of intolerance and attacks against lesbian and gay people, but also attacks against the supporters, the heterosexual supporters of civil rights. So in the last few months, I think our state has really become a tinderbox of hate, and it's just barely leashed the sort of anger and violence, and the lesbian and gay community is terrified. People feel like their lives are absolutely on the line and that everything is at risk now. And I think that the heterosexual supporters of civil rights for lesbians and gay men are being treated just as if they were gay. They're getting the harassment, they're getting the death threats, they're getting the angry, hateful mail, just as if they were lesbian or gay. And I think that ought to teach us something about if you accept intolerance against one group, it spreads.
Have you been subjected to harassment?
Oh, sure, on a regular basis. One of the pieces of mail we got this week had an OCA yes scrawled across the mail, and then it had a swastika, and then it said, die, fags, and lezzies. And that's sort of, you know, we get that on a regular basis. We get that kind of mail.
OCA is the acronym for the group that supports the anti-gay initiative.
Alliance. They're the group that's promoting this discriminatory measure. And then we also get the phone calls. We've our chief spokesperson for the campaign, who's heterosexual, 61 years old, a grandmother, and she also works for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, so she's a person of faith. Got death threats in the middle of the night. It's spreading.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peggy Norman, and she's the manager of the campaign in the state of Oregon that is opposing an anti-gay initiative. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Neary is with us. Lynn, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, Terry, once again today we'll be reporting on Hurricane Andrew. We'll be talking with NPR reporter John Burnett, who's in Louisiana, and he'll give us a sense of the damage that was done there by Hurricane Andrew. We'll also have a conversation with an official from the Dade County Emergency Services, Emergency Center, and she'll describe what they're facing. There are 63,000 people in Dade County who were left homeless. It's a terrible situation, and she'll tell us what they need to do there. And we'll also be talking with a New York Times reporter who's been covering racial violence in Rostock, Germany. And I'll have a conversation with a State Department official who quit his job because of his disagreement with the administration's policy on Bosnia.
Thanks, Lynn. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Peggy Norman, who heads the group that is opposing an anti-gay initiative in the state of Oregon. You say that this campaign is about changing values. Isn't that just what a lot of people are afraid of?
I think that what people are afraid of is what they have no information on. I don't think that lots and lots and lots of people are afraid of what the lesbian and gay community wants, if they have that information. The lesbian and gay community wants equal rights, nothing more. They want to be able to have a job that they can go to and that their job performance will be based on passion that they bring to their work, how successful they are at doing it, and not based on a stereotype about them. They want to be able to have housing that they can afford to rent or buy and not be discriminated against in looking for that housing. It's the simple kind of thing. They want their families to be free from discrimination and to be respected by the school system.
Now, earlier today, I spoke with Bob Knight, the director of the Family Research Council, a pro-family values group. And one of the things that he has to say is that homosexuality generally only becomes an issue when homosexuals make it one, that is, when they force their choice of behavior or approval of their choice of behavior on others. And he's most concerned not just with homosexuals who kind of quietly go about their lifestyle, but with homosexual activists who are really making it a public issue and trying to get that issue on the public agenda. I'm wondering what your reaction to that is, and if you think that statements like the one he is making is giving any gay activists second thoughts about gay activism.
What he's really saying is, if you stay in the closet and you hide and you're afraid to be who you are, and if you don't tell anyone, we'll never know, so we won't worry about you and we won't target you for a state law to discriminate against you. But if you say who you are, and if you say, I believe I deserve equal rights, you know, I think that what he's saying is that if you're scared and you're fearful, that's where we want you. But if you dare to ask for the same rights that everyone else has, then we're going to target you, and we're going to come after you, and we're going to do everything we can to make you scared and fearful again. So I don't think that it's going to have the effect that he wants. I think what it's going to do is appall the heterosexual community and say, look, we may not like everything about this, but we don't want a group of our citizens to be official second-class citizens. That's not the kind of state that we want to have.
Have you been doing one-on-one debates with people from the other side who support the initiative?
Yes, yes. And I think that they use the message that he used. They also say, well, we just don't want you to have special rights. And that's their sort of tag phrase. It means virtually nothing. In the law that they've proposed to amend our state constitution with, they talk about quotas and affirmative action. And, of course, there is no affirmative action, nor any single proposal anywhere that I'm aware of, for affirmative action for lesbians and gay men. It's a nonsense issue that they have brought into the debate or tried to bring into the debate. And I think the public is beginning to see through that. The public is beginning to say, look, what you're really saying is nonsense. Nobody's asking for that. They're asking for equality under the law. And if you're a citizen, you ought to have that.
Do you think this initiative is bringing forward more people as activists who hadn't been activists before or perhaps hadn't even been publicly gay before? Or do you think it's perhaps driving people more into the closet and making them retreat from activism because they're afraid of the consequences?
I will tell you that people in this state who are lesbian and gay are scared. They're not paralyzed, but they are very, very scared. And I will tell you that some of the supporters in this state that are heterosexual are beginning to say, well, who's next? Who's next? So the fear is there. But it is, in a sort of painful way, forcing us all to say, I've got to do something about this. And the coalitions that are being forged are amazing. And the number of people that are taking personal risks to say, hey, I'm a juvenile court judge, and I'm also a lesbian, and I won't be able, I'm an award-winning, employee, but I won't be able to do my job if this law passes. And teachers saying, I will be fired. And counselors saying, I won't be able to do my job any longer. People are really, whether they are homosexual coming out or whether they are heterosexual coming out in favor of our campaign. It's happening all across the state. Very brave and courageous stands and great risks being taken by people who say they just can't sit by and see this kind of thing pass.
Peggy Norman directs No on 9, the coalition opposing ballot measure number 9 in Oregon, which would require the state government to discourage homosexuality. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, and Stephen Waterman. Our program was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, David Byrne. We'll talk about his years with Talking Heads and his more recent music inspired by Latin rhythms. We'll also find out what happened to the ukulele he used to play and why he gave up performing in a T-shirt. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.